Hello, this is Kevin Barrett of the Real Alternative Media. I haven't said anything very nice about Alex Jones for several years now, and I'm sure that he hasn't said very much nice about me. In fact, when Jeremy Rothkuchel called into Alex's show not so very long ago and mentioned my name, Alex turned white as a sheet. He sounded like he'd heard a ghost. And he quickly hung up on Jeremy. Well, back in the day, it wasn't that long ago, when Alex and I got along fine. I recorded a show with him in his studio in Austin, Texas in 2007. And then in, I believe, 2011, Alex Jones and InfoWars posted a very kind remark about me. They had brought Alan Sabrowski on InfoWars, on Alex's show, after I had interviewed Alan, and Alan had come out on 9/11 as a former strategist insider with the Marine Corps and various U.S. military academies. Alan had publicly announced on my show that he and his colleagues had discussed the fact that flat out Israel was behind 9/11. At that time, again, I think it was 2011, Alex Jones didn't have a problem with that. And so he actually said something about, oh, that Kevin Barrett, he's great, or something like that. But things have changed since then, apparently. Well, maybe they've changed with Alex Jones, but they haven't changed with me or with Alan Sabrowski. So I'm inviting Alan Sabrowski back on to talk about the current wave of censorship that is sweeping the internet and even alternative radio outfets like KBOO Portland, where I was recently banned right before I had an interview with John Shuck. And there's so many other examples. So we're talking about censorship and picking up the conversation about Zionism and 9/11, where it left off back in, again, I think it was about 2011. So before we get to the interview with Alan Sabrowski, I'm going to play you a two-minute ad I just recorded for Gilad Atzmon's upcoming appearance here in Madison, Wisconsin. So here we go with the ad. Hi, I'm Kevin Barrett of TruthJihad.com with a politically incorrect question. Has the left been ruined by identity politics? The left used to be about freedom, justice for all, and sharing the wealth. But now, it's all ID politics all the time, and it seems like everybody's getting on board. Believe it or not, there are actually literal Nazis out there playing the identity politics game, saying, don't call us Nazis, call us National Socialists. Okay, Adolf, Sig Heil, whatever swats your swastika, whatever goose is your goose stuff. Hey, if that isn't enough, now there are truck attack terrorists from the Guys Who Can't Get Laid rights movement. Of course, they would prefer that we call them involuntary celibates, or the incels. And please do use the correct gender pronoun when you refer to them. What can possibly be next? Are the naked Waffle House shooters going to say, don't call us naked Waffle House shooters, call us naturist Belgian breakfast establishment marksmen? If you've seen nothing, if the absurdity of identity politics remains unknown to you, then I would suggest you allow the 10th of May to pass unmarked. But if you see what I see, if you feel as I feel, and if you would seek truth as I seek truth, then I ask you to stand beside me this May 10th at the Wilmar Center, 6:30 p.m., to listen to Gilad Atzmon, the ex-Israeli jazz legend, who may also be the world's most incisive critic of identity politics. Gilad Atzmon is the author of the Anti-Identity Politics Manifesto, Being in Time. For more information, check out the WORT Insurgent Radio Kiosk, or go to uwsw.blogspot.com. Welcome to Truth Jihad Radio. I'm Kevin Barrett, waging the all-out struggle for truth, because the Prophet Muhammad, peace upon him, once said, the best jihad is a word of truth flung in the face of an oppressor. So let's start flinging them. I guess today Alan Sabrowski has flung some of the most hardcore 100 megaton words of truth into the face of the oppressors, specifically those who pulled off the 9/11 false flag act of treason that you could ever imagine. And he's kind of legendary in this respect, even mentioning the name Alan Sobrowski in a library Q&A, at least if you're in Kansas City, can get you and the librarian arrested. That's what Jeremy Roth Kruschel found out. So I'm speaking to a living legend here. Hey, welcome, Alan Sobrowski. It's great to have you back.
Thank you very much. You ought to actually be very, very careful about this. A few years ago, I had a telephone interview with a journalist for American Free Press, who also did a lot of other books, named Vic Thorne, who came up with the Clinton Body Count book. Yeah. And he was the most upbeat guy I had talked to in years. I mean, you're fairly upbeat, but he made you seem really dour and almost Presbyterian.
Me? Presbyterian?
No. I mean, I said almost.
Okay.
As a sense of a doer Scots, you know, you can do that.
Unitarian, but anyway.
Yeah, maybe something like that. But he had like three book contracts. He was finishing a book on that, you know, really upbeat on it. And shortly after that, he supposedly committed suicide on his 54th birthday. I'm not a psychologist or a psychiatrist. My field is political science and history. But the ultimate censorship is to kill someone. And I had never talked to a person, I think, in years who I would consider to be less likely to have done it.
Well, you know, Vic Thorne and Mike Piper, you know, both of them worked for American Free Press, and both of them died under somewhat suspicious circumstances. And now I'm writing for American Free Press, so maybe I should have made sure that they gave me a life insurance policy along with the $200 per article they gave me.
Or that you had Jeremy talk to me instead of you doing it so that they had off him. That would have been another alternative on it.
Yeah.
But I wasn't being facetious. You know, the ultimate censorship is to kill someone. And there's an awful lot of that going on under truly suspicious circumstances. Normally, from what I can tell, it's mostly journalists. It's not, you know, not so much your run-of-the-mill activists or even people like me who are sort of pounding the table out in the hinterland. But there's a fair amount of that taking place. And I think that, you know, we ought to understand that staged suicide has always been one of the instruments of authoritarian and totalitarian regimes.
That's right. Well, if anybody ever finds me with two bullets in the head, like they found Gary Webb, it was not a suicide.
Well, I'll remember that, but I'll wait until I'm in the fastness of Switzerland with about a dozen Swiss soldiers around me before I bother mentioning it.
Okay.
Well, but very seriously, on a less gruesome note, I have run into the same sort of censorship, you know, on being in Facebook jail under some really odd circumstances, you know, that you sort of scratch your head and you'd like to think it's the Facebook algorithm. And if Zuckerman hadn't hired so many Israeli officials to go into senior positions at Facebook, I might believe that. On the other hand, I know a little bit about computers. And I don't see that an algorithm would be sufficiently, how should we put this, culturally sensitive to these so-called community standards. I mean, one of them that I ran into was a cartoon of the Swedish foreign minister looking at an eye chart, which had, you know, ISIS, 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 ISIS on it. And then she's reading Israel, 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 Israel. That got me in Facebook jail for 24 hours.
Yeah, I can see that. It's funny you bring this up because my wife just a few minutes ago sent me a message that she's now in Facebook jail, and she thinks it was because of her anti-Israeli post.
It probably is. The second one that I got was even more interesting, and that is I posted a picture that I just – without commenting on it. It was of Adolf Hitler, but it was the 1938 Time magazine cover naming him Man of the Year.
Mm-hmm.
And I, you know, how does a Time magazine cover violate community standards?
This is what they did to the Honorable Minister Louis Farrakhan, right? You know, he said something about, you know, uses the phrase great man, referring to Hitler, but not in a positive sense, in the sense of, you know, somebody who greatly affected history. And they've never let him forget it.
I know that's true. And you know, we might not like them, but people like Attila the Hun and Genghis Khan affected history a lot more than any altruist you're going to find out there. And that they would be great in that sense of affecting history. But what the thing I found now increasingly, and I've been checking with a lot of my Facebook friends, excuse me, I told you, I'm still getting over flu and it's a little bit awkward. At this point, I guess no more than 10 to 15% of my Facebook friends ever see or are aware of my posts.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they've tweaked the algorithms to make sure that happens.
And because I wasn't aware of that. And when I realized that people that normally would respond were not doing so, I randomly went down the list and pulled out 20 names, you know, 20 of my, I don't know, 1,800, something like that. And only four, and these are some of the oldest Facebook friends, and only four of them had ever seen or been aware of any of my posts or could see them on my page.
Wow. So yeah. even if they went to your page, they wouldn't see them?
That's what they said, because I asked them to do it. I said, the ones who had not been notified of it, I asked them, could you go to my page and just tell me what's the latest post? And here I am looking at the latest post. And it's of the 20th Armored Division going into 20th U.S. Armored Division going into the Dachau concentration camp. The first American unit in it.
The one Ronald Reagan imagined that he was in.
And here are the inmates, well-fed, round cheeks, wearing their street clothes, no prison garbs, no striped coats, you know, applauding and cheering and like very vigorous and like that. And you say, this doesn't look like starving, brutalized people.
That's not what I saw in the movie Night and Fog.
Yeah, not quite like that on it. And 2 days later, there was another film on Dachau that was a different American unit. And now all of the inmates are thinner and they're wearing these striped concentration camp outfits. So it was sort of like a Hollywood production.
Wow. This sounds like the kind of thing that Jim Fetzer thinks about Sandy Hook.
Yep. Well, I really don't look at domestic terrorism. The only thing that I know about domestic terrorism or domestic acts, whether they happened or not, was the events in San Bernardino.
Oh, yeah. Come on. Eyewitnesses said that was three large white paramilitaries, you know, not a Muslim guy and his 90-pound wife.
Yeah, I was listening to BBC because BBC World Radio has got a little better coverage of things than anything you'll find in the U.S.
Which isn't saying much.
It's true. It's getting corrupt. But, I mean, they patched in and broadcast it because of the type of an event. And they described three tall white men in black jumpsuits with rifles. Mm-hmm. And I thought, oh, Lord. It's one of those Orange County militia outfits. Because San Bernardino, which you may or may not know, is a heavily black area.
Yeah, and it's supposedly notoriously corrupt as well. You know, I actually lived in Newport Beach and Costa Mesa briefly when I was a kid. So I kind of and I still have a sense of that Orange County milieu. It's got like their John Birch Society millionaires and then their, you know, Mexicans and blacks. And it's a very interesting place.
It is. And in fact, one of my officers, a lieutenant, he's the first lieutenant, just before we deployed to Vietnam back in the ancient days of the 1st Marine Division, arranged a meeting for us being about a dozen sergeants and lieutenants in the battalion who we thought were congenial to that point of view, and with a couple of guys from the John Birch Society in San Clemente. And we went in there and they gave us a slideshow, and they had flags and rifles all over the walls. You know, and here you've got a dozen Marines, and we know we're deploying. We know we're deploying, and we aren't privates. You know, these are sergeants and officers. And we looked at each other, and he understood that he had lost us and went off on us as communist sympathizers and all the rest of that. And we sort of said, this guy is off the track. You know, but anyway.
Well, now looking back, wouldn't you say that those John Birch Society people, even though they were a little off in certain ways, they actually did see some things that the mainstream didn't see?
Absolutely. I don't think there's any question about it. They did. The difficulty is that they didn't know how to limit it. Mm-hmm. And, you know, as I've told some friends of mine that, you know, that there are conspiracies somewhere does not mean that everything is a conspiracy. Mm-hmm. And to take that prism and view life in which everything is a conspiracy, no matter what it is, everything is a conspiracy, mm-hmm. is going to take you as far afield as being able to say, anywhere.
Yeah, that's a great point. And that's, you know, there is that real bifurcation between people like me and you who would say the world is full of conspiracies. You know, everybody's constantly conspiring. And you know, what are they looking for up at the top of the power pyramid? They're looking for more wealth and power. And then they alternately compete and conspire, you know, collaborate and compete. And so we have multiple conspiracies going all the time. It's not one single eye in the pyramid that's running everything, except maybe God, but that's a metaphysical conspiracy theory.
Yeah. I'd be sort of reluctant to go that way. But, you know, when the San Bernardino, as I watched it morph from these three tall white men and this woman who was talking, I don't know if you've heard the tape of this. I think I downloaded it from BBC. I mean, it's a woman. She's in the building where the shooting is happening, and you could hear the gunfire in the background, you know. And she said that they had pushed desks and chairs against the door, you know, to keep whatever was there out. And she had seen them through the doorway, coming up the hallway, firing into rooms. And, you know, I mean, she was very clear. Mm-hmm. What it was. This is, you know, mm-hmm. I mean, she wasn't hysterical. She was obviously frightened, but she wasn't hysterical. And she was more concerned. I don't know what her position there was, but she and some of the other older people, older that, you know, in their 30s or 40s, you could tell from the voices that they weren't teenagers, you know, were doing their best to make the room as secure as possible so that whatever was out there couldn't get in. And no ambiguity or uncertainty on her part about what she was seeing. And then when it came down to a diminutive Asian couple, you know, it's like, excuse me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
that was one of two that I have real uncertainty about. I just don't see how it's possible. And the other one was the Orlando shooting.
Yeah,
you know, in the nightclub. I don't know if people who have not been in the military are aware of this, but I don't think Tillman, you know, who died in Afghanistan, mm-hmm. could carry all the ammunition and all the loaded magazines and ammunition that it was necessary to do that much shooting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The weight is prohibitive, absolutely prohibitive. And no matter what the sexual orientation of the people getting shot, when he has to stop and flip out a magazine and reach inside a bandolier to put another one on, some of those people are going to rush him.
Yeah. Yeah. That was a ridiculous job of shooting. And then we got all kinds of other lies about that, including the FBI actually leaned on the former wife of Omar Mateen to stop mm-hmm. talking about the fact that Mateen was gay and a regular at the Pulse nightclub. But that's been established by multiple witnesses, including people yep. who hung out at the Pulse. But the FBI doesn't want you to know that Mateen mm-hmm. was gay. Why would that be? Well, maybe because there's a Muslims hate gays narrative that's being imposed on the liberals so that the liberals won't get too sympathetic with Palestinians and other oppressed Muslims. And this happened right after Muhammad Ali had died, and we had a week of nonstop celebration of Muhammad Ali, who was a strong pro-Palestinian voice, a strong voice mm-hmm. of justice, a strong voice of Muslims standing up against this post 9/11 war on Islam. And that probably was too much of the wrong kind of PR for them. So they had to stage this Orlando thing. It's interesting you mention this, because I actually put, you know, I've done three books on recent false flags And I did cover San Bernardino in one of them, and another one is devoted to Orlando. But the other two that you haven't brought up are the two Paris 2015 attacks, Charlie Hebdo on January 6th, and then the November 15th attack. I'm sorry, November 13th attack, Friday the 13th, I think. Those two were also equally obvious false flags.
Yeah, I haven't looked much at the European ones. You know, I concentrated more on the American ones.
These European ones are important.
That is certainly a second form of censorship. That a false flag is a form of censorship, in that you structure the news and the reports about incidents to create the preferred image in the preferred message that you want to carry over. So, you know, one is that you can stop a message from getting out there, which is probably what's happened to me and you and your wife and a lot of other people. And the other one is to censor the message so that you take what is an accurate representation of events and warp it completely out of any context. Mm-hmm. And I think there's no question at all about that. The third one, obviously, YouTube is now getting really interesting. You know, it's taken Alison Weir's channel off.
Yeah, isn't that amazing? I mean, Alison Weir is far from a, you know, controversial, scary kind of person. I mean, compared to me, she looks kind of like, you know, Mother Teresa. But somehow, I guess her information is so explosive that they just don't want it to get out.
Yeah, Kevin, I would never describe you as a Mother Teresa.
No, that would be Allison compared to me. I'm the Charlie Manson next to Mother Teresa. You know, she's the Mother Teresa.
you realize the next thing I'm going to read is that you've been arrested for looking at Charles Manson as an idol.
Yeah, well, I don't know about arrested, but they'll, you know, if I still had a Wikipedia page up, that would undoubtedly go up there. You know, Kevin Barrett idolizes Charles Manson. Yeah, did I ever tell you about how Wikipedia kept slandering me as a Holocaust denier and a fan of notorious Holocaust deniers for many years, and there was no way to get this off the Wikipedia page, even though it was unsourced except to some blog that nobody had ever heard of?
But certainly you don't believe in the Holocaust.
Well, at that time, I still more or less did. I mean, I'd been in Morocco for a year doing Fulbright research, and none of the couple dozen professors that I worked with believed in the Holocaust. And they all were very quick to say, you know, hey, by the way, have you read, you know, Faurisson, you know, and so on. And I just said, oh yeah, well, you know, whatever you guys have your theories. I didn't think they were right. I figured there was no chance they were right. They were probably, you know, so caught up in the anti-Zionist thing that they were willing to believe whatever they wanted to believe. But then, you know,
how old are you, Kevin?
I'm going on 60. Next year I'll be 60. Okay.
Yeah. So did I'm you hear about, around. You know, then I never, I'm 76. And when I was in a very good public high school and the first couple of years of college in the late 50s and early 60s, there was nothing in lectures or texts about the Holocaust. Mm-hmm. Not a word. There were a couple of movies that had it, The Young Lions, for example, that had something on it. But in terms of the academic curriculum in a college prep high school and the actual first 2 years of college, it wasn't there. My wife in Pennsylvania 5 years later, in a different state, I was in Michigan, she was in Pennsylvania, never had anything about it, including at the University of Pennsylvania. Her sister, who's 10 years younger, did have it, had a lot of it. And what changed in that period was that AIPAC rose up as a, you know, from the ashes of a couple of other global Jewish organizations and became a powerhouse with a lot of money and a lot of clout.
Right. Yeah. Well, Norman Finkelstein thinks that the 1967 war also had a lot to do with it, because before that, apparently the American Jewish community was not nearly as focused on the Holocaust, and also not nearly as excited about Israel. And then in 67, the this war of aggression that succeeded so well and stole all that territory made Israel out to be a winner. And so suddenly everybody jumped on board the bandwagon of the winner, and all of these rabid, you know, right-wing Zionist kinds of attitudes became totally mainstream, especially in the Jewish community. And then that contributed to blowing up the Holocaust industry. That, and of course, Finkelstein, though, he doesn't question the, you know, the Holy Trinity of the Holocaust story, which of course is the 6 million Jewish dead, the gas chambers killed millions of them, and all this was done as part of a Führer-ordered bureaucratic extermination program. And so those are the three things that get debated by the so-called revisionists. But Finkelstein actually, he's against the revisionists in that debate. And he badmouths them. But he does point out that the Holocaust industry sprang up post-1967 to shove its version of events down everybody's throat and make huge piles of money in the process.
Yep. What's even more interesting, and a reflection of this, is that in 1967, the Israeli forces were overwhelmingly using British and French weapons. Planes, tanks, artillery, and everything else. And in fact, if you read any of the books on the attack on the USS Liberty, the Mystère and Mirage fighters were French that went at it. Mm-hmm. And the tanks being used were Centurions and Chieftains. In the 1973 war, they were flying American aircraft and using American tanks.
Yeah, well, that is a huge change, because in Suez, back in the 50s during the Suez crisis, it was the British, the French, and the Israelis who were attacking Egypt, and the U.S. told them to call it off. It was Eisenhower actually who stepped in and said no. So at that point, the Zionists had captured France and Germany a lot more than they'd captured the U.S. But according to I want to get your opinion on this. According to the analysis of Laurent Guyonneau, whose new book, From Yahweh to Zion, is a must-read, the Zionist takeover of the U.S. hinged above all on the assassination of John F. Kennedy. Of course, Mike Piper has made this case too, and Laurent Guyonneau gives us a somewhat more sophisticated historical analysis of all of this. Do you think those guys are right?
No. Okay. I think that what the assassination of Kennedy and the assumption of power of Johnson did was give Israel a green light for the development of a nuclear weapons. Mm-hmm. And that Jewish scientists, and we know this, Jewish scientists at the Oak Ridge Laboratory managed to illegally funnel a lot of enriched uranium to the Israelis to help on this. So it took that off, and it took the basic blocks off that type of control. No, I think it was actually I don't know if I would say a more sophisticated strategy or a more complex strategy, a complex in which, you know, assassinating the president who told the Israelis not no nuclear arms, not only no, but hell no. And he dies, you know, within a very short order. And the person who comes back into power is someone who is sufficiently impressed or frightened of the Israelis that even when they attack a U.S. Navy ship in the 1967 war, he won't do anything to them, even when there's two carriers close by that can intercept it.
But wait a minute, was Johnson just impressed and cowed by the Israelis, or was he himself tied very, very deeply to the Kosher Nostra? You know, the Dixie Mob, the Kosher Nostra, same thing. You know, this is where Guyonneau's analysis gets really interesting.
I would think it's both of them. This is not an either or choice.
Yeah.
I mean, knowing how the mob works, he understands how they deal with people who step out of line. Mm-hmm. So it's not an either or, and that's one of those things. Is it this or that? And you say both.
Yeah.
Or I would say both. No, I think what we saw is in the 1960s and 70s. Particularly in the 60s and 70s, going into the 80s, is that AIPAC very quickly spawned another PAC, CUFI, Christians United for Israel, whose executive director and director of communications are today and always have been former AIPAC officials. Just to be sure that the evangelists don't get off message, you know, that these two groups begin lobbying very effectively on Capitol Hill and within some key states and helping fund the takeover of a lot of major networks and newspapers. This continued into the 70s and 80s and began spreading into the publishing industry. You know, it wasn't like this all happened at once and suddenly a switch was turned and bang, they've got their control. There were still senators and congressmen in the 60s and 70s who could publicly stand up, oppose AIPAC, and be reelected. But, you know, that they became fewer and fewer as the years went on. And so this was a fairly long-term process, about a 30 to 40-year process, at the end of which they owned both houses of the Congress, all the major national newspapers, all of the networks, even down to CMT and ESPN and Disney.
Yeah, and they took over CNN from Ted Turner, who was the last Goy media mogul.
Yep. And all three weekly news magazines, Time, Newsweek, U.S. News and World Report, all of them. So you've got, and they had a lot of evangelical Protestant ministers who they very carefully cultivated, you know, awards, monies, free trips to Israel for them and their family and their staff, all the rest of that.
Do you think all of that, like, kind of the sex scandals that broke out around people like Falwell and Swaggart, I remember, you know, these Sunday morning TV preachers who were doing these really depraved sexual things, is that like the tip of an iceberg in which the Zionists are sexually compromising people?
I don't think they had to sexually compromise people like Jimmy Swaggart.
Maybe not.
You know, I really don't, any more than they would have to sexually compromise people like Jesse Jackson. You know?
How about Trump?
Jeffrey
Epstein, right? I mean, he's an old friend.
You know, I'm surprised that they're letting this happen. I mean, if nothing else, with his family connections to Israel and the extent to which he so obviously favors them, I would think they would want to keep him around. Although at this point, since there is no possibility of a serious presidential contender from any party getting the nomination, much less getting elected, unless they support Israel, you know, why should they bother? It may not matter to them at this point. Mm-hmm. You know, 30, 40 years ago, it would have mattered, but not now. But the net effect of all of this is that they have such a lock on the information coming from press. I'm speaking, when I say press, I mean electronic and printed, from press, from politicians, and from the pulpit, coming to the people, that there is very little dissension, very little dissent, rather, out there for anyone who questions this to find any support.
Well, you get the sense that the internet does have more and more and more people who are generally bright people waking up to this situation.
I think that is true, but you know, you've got CNN alone, which will have about 800 to 1 billion viewers a day. And I don't know any alternative media website on the internet that gets 800 million to a billion hits a day.
Well, Truth Jihad Radio may not quite yet, but we're working on it.
maybe you should call a Truth Zionist and just keep your theme message, just change the label, and they might support you.
Right. Apply for funding. Yeah.
something like that. But yeah. It's really interesting that you can almost track happening from the early 60s on what people like Senator Fulbright warned would happen.
Mm-hmm. And, of course, he got thrown out of the Senate by the Zionists.
Yeah, and it did. And it did. I mean, even representatives, one of the very few representatives who breaks rank on some issues, Tulsi Gabbard, you know, on the Syria bit, even she does her genuflection to APAC.
Yeah. And how big a factor was 9/11 in all of this? Because it seems to me that 9/11 terrorized the country, like Dan Rather said. It put flaming tires around everybody's necks, made fear the only political factor really that mattered anymore, and it marginalized anybody who has the slightest interest in all too obvious truth.
I don't think that it was part of the same process, but it was part of a corresponding process, in that before there was a strong support, an increasingly strong support for the Israeli position on almost everything, but it didn't really translate into an Islamophobia. What 9/11 did, I mean, there were traces of it, but it wasn't that virulent. Reagan could still send troops to Beirut in 1982 to block the Israeli advance, and there wasn't any great outcry in the U.S. for him doing that. But what it did was focus it in an offensive way. And I don't mean offensive and personally offensive, but it is offensive that way too, but in an aggressive way. Not only are we going to support one, we're going to actively take out almost anyone else out there.
Mm-hmm.
And I think one of the classic interviews is a brief 7-8 minute video with Wes Clark, General Wesley Clark, a few years after his retirement, where he talks about a friend of his in the Pentagon, another general, saying, you know, it's we're going to war with Iraq. This is a couple of weeks after 9/11. And Clark says, why? And he said, the other general says, I don't know. And he said, are they associated with 9/11? He says, no. And a few weeks later, when he's back, this other general hands him a piece of paper and says, I didn't give you this. And he said, what? He said, the decision has been made upstairs, and that means Rumsfeld, Wolfowitz, and Feith, to take out 7 countries in 5 years. 7 Middle East countries in 5 years. Regime change in 7 countries in 5 years. Nothing to do with 9/11. Nothing at all. And I think the only reason that they didn't do that in that 5-year time frame is the completely unexpected strength of the Iraqi resistance.
Yeah.
You know, it kicked things off the rails. But yeah, as of right now, the only one of those 7 that hasn't been taken out is Iran.
That's right. Which is where I'm going. That's where I'll be on May 15th, which is Nakba Day. It's the day that the Israelis celebrate their genocide of the Palestinians, and the Palestinians mourn that genocide. And this year, the Great Return March is going to show, it's going to give us huge numbers of Palestinians walking right up to that border fence, unarmed, trying to walk back to their land that they were ethnically cleansed from so murderously in 48, 67, and so on. So we're having a big conference in Mashhad, Iran, to commemorate this. And it's going to be interesting to see where this all goes. I mean, because Trump is moving, he's opening the U.S. Embassy in Jerusalem a couple days before that. And so all of this seems to be kind of coming together at the same time.
Well, it probably is. I'm not a big believer in peaceful or nonviolent resistance. And that's not strictly within the Palestinian or Middle East context. And I'll tell you why in just a minute. There's I'm one of these guys who has a certain affection for historical fiction, alternate history, and stuff like that. And everyone who talks about peaceful resistance or nonviolent resistance invariably will reference Gandhi.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and the fits that he gave the British. And this sort of takes the point that, well, it's not only who does this, but who you're doing it to. And this is one of those alternate histories where the Germans won World War II in Europe. Okay, they didn't take Britain, but they knocked the Soviet Union off, and they got the British colonies, and they got India. And there's a German field marshal who's now the governor of India. And Gandhi comes up to him, and he and Nehru, when they realize that he's not going to withdraw the German army from India, do to him what they did so successfully to the British. And he answers with machine guns and tanks.
Now, is this an actual alternate history novel?
It's an alternate history short story. Yeah,
Okay.
I'll send it to you. I'll send it. You might find it an interesting read because it's not only a strategy, nonviolence, peaceful resistance. It's not only a strategy devised by someone to use, but it takes a proper assessment of against whom you're going to use it. You know, I mean, there's no question about that. Had Martin Luther King Jr. in this country, tried his marches 50 years earlier, excuse me, there wouldn't be a statue to him, there'd be a gravestone. Period.
Yeah, but in this case, you're right that nonviolent strategies are going to have absolutely no effect on the Israeli leadership and 90% of the people of Israel, who are all very much comparable to Hitler and his people, if not worse. That part's right. But in the larger strategic picture, American Jews, who are the main source of support for Israel, that's all that's kept Israel around for the past 5 decades, are increasingly turning against Israel because of its horrendous human rights abuses. And in that situation, even though a Gandhi-style approach obviously isn't going to change Bibi Netanyahu's mind or the mind of the 90% of Israeli Jews who are genocidal lunatics, it will very likely change the minds of a significant number of Americans, especially people in the American Jewish community, and not to mention world public opinion. And as U.S. public opinion, U.S. Jewish public opinion, and world public opinion increasingly turns against the Zionists, it does seem to me that the medium-term strategic picture starts to look much, much worse for the Zionists.
The only thing is, Kevin, at this point, the Israelis don't need the American Jewish community that much. They own the rest. And they've almost completely eliminated what's been. I'll tell you this much, my personal reading is that once the US, with or without Israel, attacks Iran, you're going to have a massive ethnic cleansing. And I don't know if it's going to affect the Arab citizens of Israel, the ones that hold Israeli passports. That I'm not sure of. I could see that going both ways. But the Palestinian population of East Jerusalem and the West Bank is going to be shoved into Jordan. And the Palestinian population in Gaza is going to be shoved into the Sinai. And that's end game and match. And they don't need this anymore.
Yeah, I think
They're
that
new.
is Netanyahu's end game for sure.
Oh, there's no doubt at all about that. I talked to Ken O'Keefe before the second convoy that went over there, and it was such a disaster. I said, the only thing that matters to the Israelis is their own casualties. And going over there and saying, hey, we're unarmed. All you do is give them an easy piece of meat.
So,
That's
so
all
what's
they're
the
going to do.
best way to threaten them with casualties?
If you're coming in with convoy, with ships, be armed for self-defense. Basically, infantry weapons, grenade launchers. They'll have to sink the ships if they want to do it on the high seas. And you remember what happened to the Turkish ship when that happened, and there was even a small number of casualties. The Israelis took a huge propaganda hit, a huge one. And if the ships actually resist, if they actually resist, that's one way. Second would be to slip weapons into the West Bank, and it can be done. I mean, there are arms dealers out there with mercenaries who'll be more than happy to do this. And there's lots of money around there, and hit Israeli settlements. And the third is to tell the Palestinians in Gaza to get rid of those goddamn useless unmanned and unaimed rockets. They do nothing except give the Israelis a propaganda victory. Get a smaller number of weapons, and the next time the Israelis hit, have you seen the pictures of the Israeli artillery when every time they're shelling Gaza? They've got the ammunition stacked right next to the guns. No one does that unless they're absolutely certain they're not going to be hit. Mm-hmm. And use it. Inflict as many casualties as you can. I remarked to someone who became, well, I made a post on this, and it caused me a Facebook post caused me almost as much hostility from Palestinians and their supporters as it did from the Israelis. And I said, you know, if the Palestinians had resisted the settlements half the way that the Afghans and the Iraqis have continued fighting, there wouldn't be any settlements.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
Well, it is.
Isn't this what Hezbollah is doing? I think Iran and Hezbollah are indeed making sure that if there's another big war, that Hezbollah is going to have a lot more to hit Israel with than they did in 2006, and possibly will have the ability to utterly annihilate Dimona, among other things, not to mention some urban areas in Israel. So isn't that precisely the sort of deterrent effect that you're talking about as far as being able to actually, you know, hit Israel with casualties?
Well, it's not so much a deterrent. It would probably prompt the Israelis to preempt if they thought that was coming down. But the Palestinians aren't part of that. They're largely outside of it.
Right. But you were saying if Israel, you're saying the end game is a big war starts with Iran, which is what Netanyahu's been trying to do now for 15 years. And so that if that happens, that's when death starts raining down on Israel.
Well, that's when the Palestinians start getting shoved out.
Right, but if Israel knows that if it proceeds with shoving the Palestinians out, then Dimona is gone. A lot of Israel is uninhabitable. Tel Aviv is trashed. Huge numbers of Israelis are dead. Wouldn't they perhaps reconsider?
You better think about Iron Dome and the American anti-missile system that we have put into our first permanent base in Israel. Missiles and aircraft are going to have a limited utility in going at this. Iron Dome and its American equivalent can take out most of this. So you're talking, it'd be nice to think of it. If this were 10, 15 years ago, I'd say, yeah, you're correct. No question at all about it. But the evolution of the U.S.-Israeli security arrangement is such right now that not only because of Iron Dome, the Iron Dome system, but the American base that's there, which is basically an anti-missile air defense base, you know, it's intended precisely as a hedge against these things. I mean, aircraft aren't going to make it through the Israeli Air Force. Missiles and rockets now are going to have a reduced utility. So you're talking about down and dirty. And that's a very different system. Now, if the Israelis invade Lebanon again, I have no doubt that Hezbollah is going to make them pay an even heavier price than they did the last time around. You know, there's no question at all about that. But, you know, if I were being sufficiently ruthless, which I don't think I'm as ruthless as Netanyahu, but I incline that way. You know, Marines are not nice by nature. Just not one of the
things. You had the niceness things whipped out of you in boot camp, huh?
Well, what wasn't whipped out of me in boot camp was whipped out of me in a couple of years in Vietnam, I can tell you. But I think from the Israeli point of view, if they have broken up everything else. I mean, Iraq is a mess. Afghanistan, it didn't have much to go back to, but it's been ripped up. Libya is just shambles. Syria will take generations to recover from the factional battles and civil wars there. If they can do the same to Iran, that they have done successfully using us to Syria and to Iraq and to Libya, and ethnically cleanse the Palestinians from East Jerusalem and the West Bank in Gaza. That's worth a lot of casualties.
Mm-hmm.
That's worth a lot of cash because that will be win. That means they'll have won, really have won. And they'll still own us. Can you imagine the aid and reconstruction monies that would come from the U.S. Congress to Israel after something like that?
And at what point, though, does this atrocious behavior catch up with them? At what point do enough capable people say enough is enough, time to put these folks out of business?
Well, from what my friends overseas say, they have as much control in Britain, France, Australia, New Zealand, as they do in the, and Canada, as they do in the U.S. Now, these are major economies. Germany is a mixed bag. Russia and Central and Eastern Europe are not congenial. How long would it take for it to catch up with them? I would say the end of this century, when the balance of power in the world, when the balance of hegemony in the world shifts to Asia. Because I don't think that the Chinese and Japanese will give a rat's ass about them.
You think it's going to take that long? I just read a really interesting book on the U.S. empire by Alfred McCoy, who's another relatively free thinker from the University of Wisconsin. And he's the guy who exposed the CIA drug trade and various other misdeeds. He also wrote a book on torture. And he thinks that the U.S. empire is toast by about 2030. He imagines one scenario by which it could end, which would be a war with China with zero casualties, but the complete destruction of U.S. military power by way of communications, warfare, essentially cyber warfare. And so it's if you project the trends, clearly China is going to have a lot bigger GDP by 2030. And they are putting everything into their high-tech stuff. And even just now, we see this trade war is about to break out. And it's all focused on the U.S. demand that China stop with its high-tech policy that's designed to make it the high-tech leader on Earth. So I don't know if we have to wait till the end of the century before the balance of power shifts.
Well, the balance of power may in fact shift earlier, but the destruction of the American empire doesn't automatically put Israel in danger, because there still is Canada, Britain, France, Australia, New Zealand.
Mm-hmm. And our
empire. Yeah. Basically, that's where, except for France, that's where they focus their attention.
And, the Anglo-Zionist empire, as the Saker calls it.
Yeah, I know. When I read that the first time, I laughed. I said, that's a good phrase. I wish I had thought of it.
Yeah. Trademark it. Get a nickel every time somebody uses it.
You know, say something in the last half of this century, you know, and we can battle over the years on it. But I think before it really comes home to roost, it's going to require the assumption. And I don't so much mean hegemony. That has a more direct control, but at least the assumption of preponderance. How about that?
Mm-hmm.
By Asian countries. Especially China and Japan and some of the smaller ones. Most of them it'd be interesting to see how China and Japan sort this out. But where they don't have a domestic lobby sufficiently large and sufficiently influential to dictate media policy and government policy, they don't have it.
Well, that might be why the Zionists have to, you know, do Fukushima-type stuff to try to keep Japan in line. There is that rumor out there that Japan was just about to nationalize its postal bank and was making some pro-Palestinian moves right before the Fukushima thing happened.
Yep, I've heard that too. It could be that, but China's going to be a different section. So I think, excuse me a second. Sorry.
No problem. Yeah.
I'd love to have the health.
Well, you did a pretty good job there, getting 50, you know, almost to the end of the show without even having to blow your nose.
something like that. There's a large cloud over my head, and there's the zinnias up there, so it's taking care of me. But I think it's really going to take that. It's going to be interesting to see how long it's going to take the Israelis to manufacture a war with Iran. And they would certainly, of course, prefer not to get involved themselves. They're much happier having us do it.
And how about Russia? Will they be able to keep Russia out of supporting Iran?
No, that's the $1,000 question. That is the $1,000 question. Putin is the fly in their ointment. Yeltsin or anyone like Yeltsin, piece of cake. On the rare occasions when he was sober, he would still support whatever the U.S. wanted him to do. And Putin doesn't work that way. It's sort of strange for me who spent his most of his adult life, both in the Marines and then later as a professor, in opposition to Russia generically and the Soviet Union as the manifestation of the Russian Empire, to now think of Russia as the last best hope of America.
That is pretty strange. Well, we might as well just about leave it there. We're pretty much at the end of the show. So, any final thoughts on how we should react to this wall of censorship that they're building, not only on the internet as we've discussed with YouTube and Facebook and on and on and on, but also at the Left Forum, where we are unable to hold our event due to the censorship. And places like community radio stations in Portland, I was banned from KBOO community radio. They wouldn't even allow an interview with me. More and more, it seems that they're finding ways to try to keep the truth out of any kind of arena, even these small arenas. So what should we do in response?
There is an awful lot of money in the Palestinian diaspora. There really is. And networks and newspapers are publicly traded. Have them buy a newspaper and buy a network.
Okay, real media telling the truth. What a concept. Well, thank you.
Can you imagine? The shock is almost overwhelming.
I could hardly even imagine what that would look like. Well, thank you, Ellen Zebrowski. It's always good to touch bases with you. I appreciate your great work and your hardcore commitment to truth telling, which is such a rare commodity in today's world. So keep up that straight shooting, and I look forward to continuing to talk with you, maybe actually meeting you in person, even though it's not going to happen in New York, thanks to the Left Forum censorship.
Yep.
Hopefully, it will happen somewhere.
Well, I hope it will because I will come through Minneapolis usually about twice a year in the fall and in the early winter. And I'll touch base with you in advance of that. And we may have to meet halfway between this Minneapolis and where you are, but we'll at least try something and we'll get together absolutely the next time I'm out there.
Sounds like a plan. I look forward to having a coffee with you and continuing to pick your brains because you definitely have some of the most interesting brains out there. Well, take care, Ellen. See you next time.
Thank you very much, Kevin.
Boy, I wish you could be with me right now. But this is so nice, it must be illegal. So take it easy. I'll tell you about it. This is so nice, it must be illegal, meeting you once more. Feeling so good, it could be against the law. Yes, and I'm loving you, yes. This is an age that curbs all our pleasures. Who knows what's in store? This is so nice, there must be a hidden flaw. F-L-A-W, yeah. You're so broad of shoulder, I know I'm young and older. All those dames fall in flocks. Noting your attractions, Congress may take actions and keep you underground at Fort Knox. quick, let us kiss before it's a lizard. It could happen here.